Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. My good friend Sarah Jones is a ventriloquist, a performer who spends her days talking to puppets. She's also an expert on the darker side of throwing your voice and its hidden history of witches, swindlers, and necromancers. Just when you thought ventriloquism couldn't get any creepier, this is Scammapalooza. Okay, Sarah, I have in front of me some statistics. These are important statistics as put together by the famed psychologist Richard Wiseman.
Sure.
And it's his survey of 1,000 people showing the percentage who would be prepared to go on dates with various members of the entertainment community.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, 74% of those surveyed would be prepared to date a dancer, a magician, my chosen field of endeavor, 24%. And right down the bottom with just 2% is ventriloquist, your profession. Why are ventriloquists
the
saddest?
Can I just ask, is there anyone below, is there a 1%?
There is no 1%, no. And he hasn't even bothered
to- psychics?
Nope.
Where do they come in?
Pet psychics don't even factor into it.
Get a gander. Just, I must say, when I've done online dating, I don't have many good photos of myself because most of the for various reasons, often I'm wearing a costume or I just look the worst.
Yep.
So most of the nice photos of me are the ones that are professionally taken, and the ones that are professionally taken include a puppet. So I've quite often cropped a puppet out of photo that I put on online dating. And one of them, I think I even had, it was quite an obvious crop, and I had a little disclaimer down the bottom of the photo saying, don't worry, I haven't cropped an X out of this photo. It's a puppet.
So it's clear then that ventriloquists are naturally deceptive people. You're on online dating, you're hiding your ventriloquism. Your ventriloquism.
I thought you meant I was deceptive for doing online dating. People do that these days.
No.
Come on, man.
For cropping yourself out of pictures.
I do tell people when I go on a first date with them, usually, but not always. It's sort of one of those things that you want to.
Sure.
You want to wait till they've committed to you and they can't back out.
Sure. It's a little like, you know, having kids or something. It's like, it's not necessarily something to be ashamed of, but it's something you want to bring out at the right moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Not too early, not too late.
Yeah. While he's carrying me over the threshold at our wedding day is when I'm going to tell the next one.
Yeah, that's great. He's carrying you over the threshold.
And he has a little disembodied voice coming from inside the room.
Yes.
That's when he's going to find out.
Sure, yeah. Speaking of carrying people and holding them on your knee, I have some puppets I'd like you to meet.
And they'll be all spread out across, you know, amongst the rose petals on the bed.
Yeah.
For our honeymoon.
Mm, oh, it's creepy. So, the art of ventriloquism is...
Thank you for calling it an art.
Well, we are nothing if not sophisticated and classy here at Scammapalooza. What is ventriloquism exactly?
Ventriloquism, at its most basic, is person producing the illusion that a voice is coming from somewhere else apart from them. And it's usually done with puppets, obviously. There's a concept of, you know, throwing the voice. People think ventriloquists throw their voice into a puppet. That's actually not technically true.
And that is partly the idea that your lips aren't moving.
Yeah.
If you're decent at your job, your lips aren't moving, but also a whole lot of other factors that make it seem as if this puppet is coming to life.
Yeah. People tend to focus on the lips not moving, but actually there's a whole bunch, like similar to magic, there's a whole bunch of misdirection that goes into that sort of process.
Mm-hmm.
And that more than the lips not moving is what's really important in terms of getting the audience to focus their attention where the ventriloquist would like.
And I guess also the fact that the puppet is speaking in a different voice.
Yeah. So
you can create that illusion.
So the throwing the voice principle, it works on, scientifically, it worked is similar to, you know, when you're in a car and you hear the sirens of an ambulance or something blaring behind you, often you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So you'll kind of look around. It's only when you see the ambulance itself that you kind of put the sound and the sight together and you work out the direction of that sound, because your ears are actually your weakest sense. So your eyes are pretty strong. Ears don't really have much clue what's going on. So when they hear something, they rely on all their other senses. So when a ventriloquist has a puppet and the puppet has a quite a distinct voice and the puppet's mouth is moving in conjunction with the words and the ventriloquist mouth isn't moving. And, you know, when the ventriloquist is looking at the puppet when the puppet's talking, and the puppet's looking at the ventriloquist when the ventriloquist's talking, all those sort of signals fill in for our ears where we think the sound should be coming from. And of course, in modern times, most gigs have amplification. So that further kind of diffuses the direction of the sound. If everything's coming through a microphone, it's sort of going out everywhere.
The further you are away from a ventriloquist, the more
absolutely
effective it would be.
Yeah. When the,
is that why people often, whenever they see a ventriloquist come on stage, get as far away as they possibly can
yeah.
from the ventriloquist?
And the people we try and date as well.
Yeah, that's, because there's just there's a much better effect.
Yeah.
What about a ventriloquist in an ambulance? Like, just, you know, because you've got the movement, you've got the effect of the sirens.
Yeah.
Surely I think that would be helpful.
That would be good. I'm not, like, it's a bit of a clown doctor thing, but I'm not sure if it would revive people very well to see, you know, if they come to an ambulance and see a ventriloquist dummy leering over them.
That is. So, the opposite of a clown doctor is a paramedic ventriloquist.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things with ventriloquism that I know is the hard P's. I believe they're called the labial sounds.
Yeah, which is a little snigger, racy.
A little
Plosive consonants. That's also what they're called, which is slightly less sexy.
So, saying the letter P without moving your lips, is it possible to do that?
No. Not really. To have a practice on ventriloquism, if anyone wants to play this game at home, is what you do is you lay your index finger against your lips and try and keep your lips really still and say, it's easy to talk like this.
It's easy to talk like this.
Which it is.
It is easy to talk like
it's
that.
It's super easy.
This is very easy.
And
I'm having no problem. Oh, I said problem.
Yeah. So it's only when you start to get into the plosive consonants that you start to have a little bit of trouble. So that's anything you use your lips a lot, like M and B and P.
This is why they say
that's why God of gear.
God of gear, bottle of beer. I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you do then? Do you just never say the letter P or
Sometimes,
B?
Sometimes people write scripts where they completely avoid labial consonants, which is tricky. Often they're disguised in words.
Work.
Yeah, it's just like when you're proofreading something that you've written and you misspelt words because you know what it's supposed to be.
No, I have written two novels and there were never any typos.
Is that right?
In any process. Yeah. Speaking of both books and missing letters, like writing without letters, are you familiar with the book Gatsby?
Yeah.
It's an entire book written
without the letter
A. Without the
letter A. It'd be amazing to do that.
To do that. And a complete and utter waste of time.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to ventriloquism. I don't know why I'm so mocking a ventriloquism. I think
because you're a ventriloquist and this is the only chance you get to pick on someone.
Yeah, because I'm a magician, you mean?
Because you're a magician,
yeah. This is
like,
it,
you
this
know,
is
there ain't much room in that pecking order.
That's right. I'm like one of those
nowhere to go.
Those horrible nerds on the internet who decide they're going to try and just pick fights with people in the YouTube comments because they got nowhere else to go. That's fair enough. My grandfather was a ventriloquist, so
that's in your blood.
It's in my blood. That's it.
Yeah. Are you a frustrated ventriloquist?
I'm very frustrated ventriloquist. Every time I try ventriloquism, people mock my ventriloquism.
Yeah, I do mock your ventriloquism.
I know you have mocked my ventriloquism because every time I do a puppet voice, it sounds like a
bogan.
Yeah, like an Australian hillbilly.
Yeah, how you going, mate? It's terrifying.
It's not. It's a great voice, and I'm gonna stick to it. Okay, so we've established you want to get a bit of distance. You want to from between you and the audience. You want to bring your puppet to life, make it move, look at it when it's speaking. And you want to try and avoid the labial sounds.
Mm.
When you add all that together, is that enough?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of other basic little things like projection. You're supposed to project through your nose because obviously you can't let that much air pass through your lips as much with them almost closed. It's really more about the writing, I think. Even if someone has the best technique in the world, if the writing is poor and the act isn't funny or entertaining, the audience is, of course, going to get bored and going to start looking at the ventriloquist more than the puppet. Whereas if you've ever seen a really good ventriloquist act, you end up so entranced by the actual puppet that you often forget that it even is a puppet.
Well, who's the great ventriloquist from the
Sarah Jones.
The great ventriloquist in the 1950s and 60s.
Ray Allen, maybe?
Yeah, Ray Allen. And
he's one of my favorites.
His lips moved quite a lot, didn't they?
Oh, no, that's Edgar Bergen.
Edgar Bergen. Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah. So he was on the radio predominantly in the
which I know it is, you know, 60 years of the same joke, but ventriloquism on the radio, that's shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah,
I should point out Sarah's lips have not moved at all the entire time we've been talking.
But when a performer's really entertaining, I don't think it matters that much. There's a great performer in the UK, JT Organ. He's passed away now, but he did a nightclub act, and he did what's called buckle voice, which is the sort of effect you do to do Donald Duck. That kind of, I can't do it, but
Yep.
So he used to do that with a little duck puppet, and you can't not move your lips when you do that voice, just because the way to do buckle voice, you can't do it as a ventriloquist. It's just impossible. So he moved his lips totally, but it was just the most engaging, delightful act that no one cared. I mean, the thing about ventriloquism that's different from magic, it is sort of a form of deception, but everyone's in on the joke.
Mm.
Like, there's very, unless you're performing for children or the unsound, no one's going to think that the puppet is actually real, so
there must be people in the audience who sit there and stare at the ventriloquist's lips and go, nope, her lips are moved, or I just saw something happen.
Yeah.
And go, nope, she's bad at her job, and decide that probably is not good.
Yeah.
But that sort of defeats the purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not that challenge aspect there.
Yeah, exactly. There's not like, I'm going to work out how she did it, because sort of everyone knows. You know, people always think that the not moving your lips is the trickiest bit, but actually, when you're doing this back and forth dialogue, that's usually a conflict. So usually, as a ventriloquist, you know, maybe you're trying to get the puppet to be quiet, and the puppet wants to sing a song, for example. So you're projecting one emotion, you know, sort of anger or whatever, and the puppet's, you know, excited or what have you, but you're doing both of those things at the same time. So you're acting with your hand how the puppet would act in an excited way, and talking in an excited manner, and then switching back to, you know, you being cross, and while, you know, you're responding in the same way as well. So you're responding angrily with your face while you're actually saying these excited things with the other half of your body. It's very confusing.
It's like learning to play the guitar, where one hand is doing the chords and the other hand is strumming, and being able to do them both at the same time.
Yeah. And switch between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there is also that balance, switching back between art and craft, of people. You want people to be impressed by the skill, but you also want them just to accept the reality of the situation, which is you're talking to a cat or an old man or a turtle or whatever the puppet happens to be. And so that's got to be that's got to be difficult. I mean, to sort of make them not care about your skill and make them just sort of accept it as a new reality.
Yeah, although people very quickly adjust, and people really, puppets are quite interesting for people. Like the puppets that I have are sort of designed to be interesting to look at. They have, you know, big eyes and a big mouth, so that when they're talking, it kind of draws the eye. So people very quickly forget that, you know, that they're in a little show. I often have people wanting to talk to my puppets after the show. Like I performed on a cruise ship a while ago, and there were these lovely older ladies who saw me as I left the stage, and they said, "Oh, can we have a photo with Kitten, who's my main character?" And I said, "Oh, sure." And I brought him out, and I got him to say hi, and then we posed for the photos, and then they started talking to him, saying, "Oh, you were so lovely. Aren't you so handsome?" and stuff like that. And then one of them said, "Oh, my grandchildren would love you." And then the other one butted in and said, "Oh, and I have grandchildren too," and started telling my cat puppet about the age and names of her grandchildren. And I was like left out of the conversation even.
That happened to David Strassman on his TV series, because he had a show in the late 90s called Strassman.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was basically a talk show, but with the puppets were his sidekick. And so he would have these interviews with celebrities, and there was one, I think it might have been Bruce Ruxton, who's, you know, controversial conservative figure. And the puppet, Chuck, was saying some really rude, offensive stuff to the guest. And at one point, Strassman said, "Oh, look, I'm so sorry." And Ruxton said, no, it's fine, okay? My issue's with him.
Yeah.
And just completely forgetting. And
it's a strange phenomenon, but it really does happen.
People get swept along with the illusion.
Yeah.
And I guess that's why, this is a neat segue, is why...
Less neat because you pointed it out.
Shut up. It's even more less neat. I'm going to edit that out.
Keep it in. This is for all you fans out there. This is the real stuff.
This is the deep cuts. Nicholas pointing out segues. It is a neat segue into the history of ventriloquism, which is similar to the history of magic, in that way back it started as something occult, and that people would use ventriloquism not to entertain but to convince people that they had some sort of superpowers.
Yeah.
So the word,
only it was still the same.
Only it was true. We don't really
all
worship
the power I could wield over you.
We don't really worship ventriloquists in quite the way that we did in the past.
Hey, you don't know what goes on in my private life.
So the word ventriloquism means voice from the belly.
Yeah, so it's there's This ventriloquist comes from the Latin, so ventriloquist, and it means belly talker. There's a Greek word for it, gastromancy, which means the same thing. And essentially that's because back in the ancient Greek and Roman times when ventriloquism was sort of starting, it was the effect was thought to come from the stomach, because again, when you're doing ventriloquism well, it's very hard to tell the direction of the sound. So people were seeing ventriloquism, thought the voice was being projected from the stomach.
Because there was the idea in a lot of ancient cultures that the soul, like we think of the soul being in the heart, whereas for them it was in the stomach.
Yeah, that was where all the business happened.
And so the idea of having a voice coming from your stomach was like a link to God.
Yeah. So actually it has several different origins, and there's some thought now that it might have been used in Maori religious ceremonies as well. But certainly in ancient Rome, it was used in the temples, and the oracles used to use it to convince people that they could hear the voices of gods. Which is a pretty sweet deal.
It's a very sweet deal.
Yeah.
And that is something that goes throughout, like, religion in general, is the idea that if you're the person who can control the voice of the gods, then you are the person who gets to decide what the gods
do. You're
in charge.
And it's something that's more tangible than the general, God spoke to me and he told me this.
Yeah.
If you're actually hearing them, God is speaking to us all right now, and he reckons this, that, you know, it's a little more convincing, I suppose.
I know when they introduced, the written word was introduced into religion, that there was an idea of almost magic about it, because it wasn't just here are some scribblings and I can tell you what these scribblings mean. It was this way of taking words,
communicating,
yeah, taking dead words that have happened long ago and bringing them back to life again.
Yeah.
And so it was seen as sort of supernatural and spiritual.
Yeah.
And so the idea of gastromancy sounds like it's the same sort of thing.
Absolutely.
Of being able to take voices and bringing them out. Once the church sort of took over and the sort of Christian church took over, and those sort of ideas, that kind of more occult ideas, became less popular, it seemed to go throughout the Dark Ages become a little bit grubbier.
So in the medieval times, ventriloquism was used for necromancy, which is like similar to what we do now, except instead of throwing the voice into a puppet, you threw the voice into a dead body.
Sorry, just to be clear, you practice necromancy?
Well, I could.
But I don't. But
apparently last time I ruined grandma's funeral. So that did happen, and a lot of the women that were executed during the witch trials around that time period were said to have practiced ventriloquism.
Mm-hmm.
So that could have been me, burnt at the stake.
But and in that case, though, do you think it's a sense of just people fear-mongering, like someone has this
absolutely
sort of weird technique,
yeah,
or do you think that there was really an attempt for people to claim a supernatural power to put voices into the dead?
I think they could have. There very well could have been. And it's very hard to find much, you know, actual reliable evidence one way or another. I think it very much could have happened, but I also do think that the witch trials were hysteria, and a lot of very innocent and some mentally ill people got killed.
Well, that's depressing.
Yeah.
Puppets. Hooray.
On the turn of the century, the occult was sort of quite fashionable almost. There was the rise of seances, Ouija boards, all that sort of stuff happening that people found really exciting. And I think particularly, you know, around the wartime era, when a lot of people lost a lot of lot of relatives in the war and stuff like that, there came this real fascination with kind of crossing over to the other side and speaking to the spirit world and all that sort of thing. And so it was really in sort of the 1900s that ventriloquism got very popular. It had been a form of entertainment for a little while. Since probably the 1800s,
yeah,
people had used a bit of ventriloquism as a form of entertainment. But back then, it was not in the same format that we'd see now. So back then, people rarely used puppets. They often, what was quite common was they'd have a whole routine that was just them having conversations with sort of disembodied voices, which seems such a weird concept now. And they would throw their voice into other things. So, like, there is a French ventriloquist from the 1800s called Louis Comte, who used to have a real-life talking pig, which would have been amazing. Yeah.
It sounds like this idea of, because around that time, so the late 1800s, and that people started to want to see demonstration theatre, the idea of you're demonstrating a skill or demonstrating
and a talent.
A talent and an ability. And so that's where you get doctors performing surgery in it, you know,
exactly.
people watching them. And some of these occult ideas then become, that were sort of perhaps previously seen as religious or at the very least spiritual, suddenly become more about entertainment. And so, I mean, you talked about the spiritualism movement. You do have the mediums and the psychics who are performing up on stage.
Yeah.
And you also have ventriloquists performing up on stage. But it seems like the ventriloquists got rid of the spiritual element pretty quickly, as soon as it was sort of uncovered as a trick. Because I did a little research, and there seems to be a lot of books in the 1800s explaining what ventriloquism is.
And that's why it was no longer feared, you know. In the Dark Ages, obviously, if you don't understand a concept, it's going to seem a lot more terrifying. But as soon as it's, you know, you've got books on the subject, then sort of pulls back the curtain on the whole thing and it becomes a lot less threatening. So, yeah, it wasn't really until the 1900s that people started using actual puppets. And they, you know, that sort of stereotypical wooden dummy is the sort of classic from that era. And one of the reasons they look so terrifying is because
they are terrifying.
Because they're pure evil. because they were designed for those old fashioned stages. They were designed for the old fashioned vaudeville stage that had footlights. So a little row of lights that were often gas lights down the bottom of the stage that cast a slightly green, sometimes hue. And they were performing in sometimes huge theaters, very poorly lit. And so it was important for the dummy to be able to stand out. So they have these big features and they're very crudely painted often because that's what translates best for an audience who are standing quite far away. And it always strikes me as funny that people still use the kind of classic old wooden dummy that's so horrifying, because we have the technology to make beautiful puppets nowadays. Mm. But often, stylistically, a lot of modern ventriloquists still choose to. They prefer to use the old wooden ones.
That's a little like people who want to do Shakespeare dressed up in tights. That's what you've got to wear, tights, to do Shakespeare. Yeah. I guess it's people, it's those people traditions. Because ventriloquism it's not dying, but it's in a lull of its popularity at the moment.
Yeah.
And at those times when things have a lull, the people who keep it alive are those who have a passion for the tradition. And, you know, I know when magic was, you know, a little less popular than it is today, it was the old men in the clubs who were doing 100-year-old tricks. Sort of keeping it going.
Yeah. And it definitely is a sort of art form that, you know, through its whole history was really passed on from performer to performer, which is why it's such a struggle that there's so few ventriloquists these days. I think there's only maybe 5 in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Because there just aren't as many people to pass it on, which is a bit sad.
Yeah, and it is a difficult skill to learn without someone to show you or to point out the mistakes you're making.
Well, I mean, I taught myself from books, but it wasn't easy.
The heyday of popular ventriloquism, so the heyday of when ventriloquism was at its greatest, was the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, it's that sort of classic story of video killed the ventriloquist star.
You think TV killed the ventriloquist? Because surely television makes ventriloquism better, because you can see the puppet, you can control where the sound is coming from, because, you know, all the sound is coming from one speaker.
Yeah.
You can control where the camera is. It seems film and TV is built for ventriloquism.
Yeah, I think ventriloquists can do really well on TV. I think just the advent of TV opened up a lot of possibilities for entertainment, you know, cartoons and all this sort of other stuff. I know it is a sort of dying art, but it has been actually having a little bit of a resurgence lately compared to, you know, the time immediately after the sort of 50s where it was very old hat.
You know, that's when you get the rise of the creepy ventriloquist movies and stories.
Yeah.
I mean, there were ones
before
that.
There's that whole subculture. Yeah, well, they've sort of existed throughout ventriloquist history.
But let's be honest, for something that started as, hey, let's see if we can make dead people talk.
Yeah, it's legit. It's legit.
It's like gotten
less
creepy.
I'm the first one to say that they're terrifying. I'm trying to write a show at the moment about a horror show about the scary side of ventriloquism, and it's been a lot of fun. I've been watching a lot of movies like that.
What are some of the classic creepy ventriloquist movies?
One of them, well, it's not a movie, but there's a Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Yes.
Episode. Often the Great Gabbo, that's one of the big ones, parodied in The Simpsons. And what I really like about ventriloquism is how deeply it pervades our culture, because I think I would have first known about ventriloquism through stuff like watching The Simpsons and seeing Great Gabbo. You know, the parody of the 1930s movie on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that just about everyone in our society will have heard of understands the concept of ventriloquism, not only understands the concept of it, but has all these weird ideas about it, like about scary dummies and, you know, all these kind of preconceived notions about throwing voices and about being able to drink a glass of water while I talk, all this sort of stuff. And yeah. That's really interesting to me that so often when I perform ventriloquism, I'm performing to audiences who've never seen a ventriloquist before. And that's just, but it's a really unique position. They've never seen a ventriloquist before, but they do have all this sort of slightly sketchy background information about them. So you can have a lot of fun playing with that.
Do you get kids scared of you and what you do?
Yes, but not because of the ventriloquist.
Just because you make them watch terrifying episodes of The Twilight Zone with creepy ventriloquists.
No, I used to do kids' parties quite a lot, mm-hmm. and I would always talk about the puppet first. What I always used to do before I brought a puppet out was I would say, I'm going to bring a friend out. Now, it's just a puppet, but, you know, we're going to have a lot of fun anyway, you know, at something like that. And that was twofold. It was to introduce the concept of a puppet so that any timid children might, you know, have a chance to compose themselves, mm-hmm. and also to cut down on the inevitable heckling of children going, that's just a puppet, because that's what they like to say if you bring out a puppet. So often I would say, now I'm going to bring out a puppet now. It is a puppet and I'll be controlling it in some little preamble like that. And you'd bring it out and a kid would go, that's a puppet. And you go, yeah, I know. And then you just move on with the show. And what I would do with younger kids, because I did a lot of fairy parties for like little girls. So, you know, when they're, you know, three or so, the puppet was often quite shy and had a really hard time, you know, coming, it was, you know, tucked into my shoulder or something, and I would have to kind of coax the puppet out to come and look at them and say hello to them and stuff. And for the children to feel like they're the brave ones was very, very important for them and very nice, because they're dependent on adults and have to do what adults say almost all the time. So when you're entertaining kids, it's really nice to give them an experience of power and control.
Although that is something that comes back, the idea of power and control is something that comes back over and over in those creepy ventriloquist movies, is that
who is controlling who?
Exactly. Who is controlling who? Yeah. You have the Twilight Zone episode. I believe it's Twilight Zone where there's the puppet, the ventriloquist puppet is sass talking the ventriloquist, and there's this tension, and you realize the ventriloquist is probably insane because he thinks the puppet's real. Mm. And then you wonder, maybe the puppet is real. And then it turns out that puppet is in fact his Siamese twin, deformed Siamese twin attached to his arm.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, there's a Buffy episode with a haunted ventriloquist.
Yeah, and there's Dead Silence. The movie as well.
That was actually surprisingly not bad. Dead Silence. I'm terrible with horror movies because I'm never that scared by them.
No, probably because we seek out ones with ventriloquists.
Yeah, they've got a whole
like
house.
Me.
Yeah. Oh, my little friends. Oh, look, they're pulling out that lady's spine. No. Oh.
That reminds me, I've got a gig. So, do you think that someone could use the skills of ventriloquism today to deceive people in the same way as it was used in the past? Do you think you could convince people that you were talking to corpses, or that you had your soul in your stomach and that's where it was coming out from? Or do you think that it's ventriloquism's day is past as far as deceiving folk?
I'd like to say no for the sake of humanity, but I've seen too many people who get suckered into it just when I'm performing. Not completely. I don't think anyone can completely fool the world like that anymore, but I definitely think that there would be people that go for it.
So I think in the right context, then, it sounds like you could. The right person, the right context.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if you're not going to fool someone forever, you're definitely going to be able to fool someone for a little bit for them to go, wait, what's going on?
What just happened here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so how exactly would we do it if we were going to set you up?
To scam the world.
We didn't even need to scam the world. We just want to make a bit of extra money on the side.
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think the easiest pickings would be the most vulnerable people, maybe someone who's lost someone. They're all the psychic mediums.
Yeah.
They tend to do a raring trade by targeting the grieving.
Yeah.
So okay. I think offering to speak to the other side, uh-huh. and get a message across.
Sure.
There's a great old joke about a ventriloquist who falls on hard times. So he decides to become a psychic, and he goes and speaks to this rich old lady who gets him to speak to her dearly departed husband. And she's so thrilled with it that she tips him an extra $100. And she says, can I see you next week? And he says, lady, for that sort of money, I'll speak to your husband while drinking a glass of water.
I like it. Oh, that's very funny. All right. That's, you know how you know that it's very funny? Because I said.
You say, that's very funny. Yeah. It's nice that you laugh as well, because there are those people that never laugh, but just say, that's funny. And you're like, is it?
Is it though? Is it? Because if only there was a way in which I could know. Do you ever get people who say, no, it's ventriloquism, it's creepy, and it's weird, and I'm out, and refuse to watch your show?
No, people just don't enjoy my show for, for legitimate reasons. I have had people not come to my show, and I've had people leave when I was about to perform because they have a deathly fear of puppets.
Yeah.
And they've come and told me afterwards, like, sorry, I walked out of the room, but I'm like, terrified of puppets. So that's a thing, and I don't fault them for that.
You don't fault them?
No.
For that? People can be scared. You're okay.
They're creepy little buggers.
The people who are scared of the puppets or the puppets?
Both. No, the puppets.
But your puppets aren't particularly creepy.
I guess not. Like, mostly I use kind of Muppety style, kind of soft puppets. But even so, it's that kind of uncanny valley thing of seeing something that shouldn't be alive, that looks sort of like they're alive. It can be unnerving.
Yeah. I think that's why the wooden face ones are so, the wooden puppets are so unnerving, is because they're trying to look like a little person and they've got their little suit and their hair is combed.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas particularly I use a lot of animals and stuff and they look like sort of a cartoon come to life rather than some creepy little man. rather than a Siamese twin coming off your body.
Coming off your body. I always like to end the podcast with the con man's dictionary. So I give you a word or a phrase that you have to try and figure out the.
Is this the Oxford con man's dictionary?
The Oxford. No, this is the Macquarie because we are in Australia. And certainly wouldn't do that. It's urban dictionary. Urban con man's dictionary. So I give you a word and then you have to try and see if you can figure out what the word means and come up with your best possible answer.
Okay.
So this is something supernatural and a little bit spooky. Mm-hmm. It's an alternative to gastromancy. Zoomantia. What is zoomantia?
Zoomantia.
Yes.
Zoo makes me think of animals.
Mm-hmm. That might be a red herring though.
That's where they live. Mantia makes me think of a mantis shrimp, but I don't think that's where you're going with this.
Sure.
I want to say it's talking for an animal, like Louis Comte did with his pigs and some current ventriloquists do with dogs, real-life talking dogs.
That is quite close, but the correct answer is that it is divination through observing the appearance or behavior of animals.
Oh.
So, you get an animal.
So, like when the horse is spooked and you're like, that means the rain's coming.
Exactly. Oh. That's right. But con artists could use the zoomantia or zoomantia by training animals to do what you want and say, if that dog sits down, then.
Wasn't there that case of that, the horse that could add up by tapping on the ground with his hoof?
Yeah.
And then they worked out that it was because he'd been subtly trained
basically he would just keep, tapping his hoof until his
owner looked relieved.
He needed to stop when his owner looked relieved. And so it was strictly, there was no con in that. I like that.
Apparently there was no con in it that the owner, it was just a happy thing that the horse wanted to do what made the owner happy.
Yeah.
It's kind of a nice story.
A lovely story and a lovely way to finish the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Can you say that again without moving your lips?
No.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.